Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Stock indexes tumble, old school financial institutions collapse, all because of a downturn in one industry, housing. Politicians and bankers are scrambling for solutions, but today on Marketplace Money, we hear from the people most affected by the downturn, homeowners. This woman's home is heading into foreclosure.
Really, any day we'll get notice of the date for the court sale.
And this guy's trying to sell his home in a neighborhood full of foreclosures.
But that's one of the signs, is when the lawn goes dead, you know that the people aren't living there anymore.
And first-time home buyers want to know if they're getting in at the bottom of the market or at a pause before another drop in prices. How did we get into this mess? And how do we get out? We've got answers coming up on Homesick, a special housing edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. If the housing market was a hospital patient, it would need some painkillers and an IV drip and a gigantic shot of adrenaline right to the heart. Stat. This week, we give the patient an examination to find out exactly what's ailing it and figure out future treatment options, since obviously it didn't get much preventive care. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Homesick, a special edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Perhaps you heard a couple of months ago when I somewhat jokingly referred to the show as Marketplace Mortgage. Well, for this week, it's official. The drumbeat of negative numbers from the housing market just does not stop. This week, we learned that defaults on privately insured mortgages rose 38% in February. Foreclosure filings increased by an almost surreal 60%. Some in Congress are floating the idea of a $400 billion bailout. And because of all of this, investors are dealing with stock market swings of 300 points or more from day to day. At some point, you just want to tune it all out. But because the real estate mess is bleeding all over the economy, you can't. So let's start things off with your friend and mine, Chris Farrell, to go over some of the basics of how we got here and why. Hello.
Hey, Tess. I'll try and give us the background here.
Let's start with this. We've been calling this a housing crisis, a mortgage meltdown for months now. But give me a little context here. How bad is this?
When we look at the housing market, it's bad. And the main measure that I would use is home prices. And if you take the home prices over the past 3 months and you annualize that, prices are falling at about a rate of 20%. And that's using the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller index of 20 major cities, which really is the index we're all using right now because it's fairly sensitive to what's happening in the market.
Well, that sounds pretty bad already. How bad could it get?
There are some indications that perhaps we're talking about a 30% decline. Perhaps we're talking even about a 40% decline. But we could also just get a long-term period of stagnation. One way of thinking about this, Tess, is that if you take the real home price from 2000 to now, they're still up 63%. During that same period of time, median household income rose about 15%. Mathematically, that suggests to me that home prices are either going to go much lower or they're going to stagnate for a long period of time until household incomes catch up with home prices.
Now, of course, I keep saying, the drop in home prices, this is a terrible thing. But on the flip side, for a lot of people, this is opportunity.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad you raised that, because what we're concerned about is this national decline in prices taking the economy down. So that's what the Fed and the regulators are worried about, and that's what they're fighting against. At the same time, if the economy is not going to collapse into a Great Depression, if we're not going to have a freeze-up of the financial system, an overall decline in home prices that makes homes more affordable for lots of people is not necessarily a bad thing. It's called a market working.
We've obviously had housing crises before in this country.
Yeah.
Can you compare the current one to previous downturns that we've seen?
Well, let's go back to the late 80s, early 90s, and the area that you live in, Los Angeles. You had a 30% decline in prices in LA. That's a real decline, adjusted for inflation. So we've had big price declines before. What makes this one unusual is really this is the first time in the post-World War II era that we're dealing with a national decline in home prices.
You say we haven't seen this since the end of World War II. How much a part of the Great Depression was the housing market?
The lesson of the Great Depression is housing prices fell, and they fell dramatically, and you also had a collapse in the mortgage market. What the Fed today is worried about is that you don't let your financial system freeze up. When the banking system fails, when the financial system fails, and all these mortgages go bad, it feeds on itself, and you end up with 25% unemployment. We have 5% unemployment today. What the Fed is trying to do is prevent the financial system from freezing on itself and the economy entering a free fall.
All right. So as we go through this hour talking about, I'll use the phrase again, the housing mess, what should listeners be keeping in mind? A, if they are currently a homeowner, or B, they are not a homeowner but would like to be?
If they are currently a homeowner and they're paying their mortgage and they're not having a lot of trouble doing it, you'll be fine, and the market will rebound at some point in the future. We know that. If you are a homeowner and you're on the financial edge, then you want to take advantage of the programs that are being offered and negotiate with your lender for a better deal. If you're a buyer, boy, I tell you, I would be improving my credit score, I would be boosting my savings, and I'd be out there looking for what is it that I want. No rush, but boy, when I'm ready to move, I'm going to buy.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
I got a little wife. She's the joy of my life. There's no place like home. I got a little house that I call my own. There's no place like home.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
So let's take a look at foreclosure itself. Here's what happens. The owner of the house can't or doesn't make the mortgage payment. After 3 to 6 months, the bank files a notice of default, usually with the county. If there's still no payment, the bank schedules an auction and sells the house. Sounds pretty horrifying, doesn't it? Foreclosure has always been the absolute last resort. You pay your mortgage even if you're not paying any other bills, right? But the math has turned. Today, people are deciding it's actually in their financial interest to be mortgage deadbeats. Maybe you've heard this term, jingle mail. Homeowners just mail their keys to the bank and walk away. Apparently, when tens of thousands of your fellow citizens are going through the same thing, it's just easier to do. Seth and Joanna Gosselin paid a final visit to their former home a few weeks ago. How long have you been out?
We've been out since September, so...
6 months?
Yeah.
They haven't paid their mortgage since last summer. Now they're in bankruptcy and foreclosure proceedings.
Lights are still on.
Yeah, so it's not in our name, but I guess they didn't cut it off.
We sat on the living room floor of their 1,200-square-foot condo in Elk Grove, California. It's a suburb of Sacramento. Just the three of us and four walls.
So this is it. This is downstairs.
It certainly sounds like an empty house.
It does. It's a little weird being here. This is my house, but it's not really my house anymore.
So where are you in the process now?
Really, any day we'll get notice of the date for the court sale.
Joanna is 24 and a stay-at-home mom. Seth is 33, and he worked for a mortgage broker until he was laid off early last year. They have two daughters, 4 and 2 years old, and a newborn son. The purchase price on the condo 3 years ago this month was $193,000. And now?
Well, the same model in the next building over is going for $95,000.
$100,000 less than what you paid for this one?
Yeah.
And what do you owe on the condo?
I believe it's around $210,000.
The Gosselins bought their home with what's known as a 2.28 ARM. The interest rate is fixed for only the first 2 years, then adjusts up. They also did 100% financing, no down payment. But later, they refinanced into an even riskier mortgage called an option arm. It allows borrowers to make payments that don't even cover the interest on the loan. That's how they ended up owing more than their purchase price.
I mean, we understood that it was a risk, but we sort of just assumed that it would kind of work out.
But it sounds like you knew what you were getting into. I mean, you understood your mortgage product. You don't feel that it was sold to you in any fraudulent manner?
No.
At the time of the refinancing, Seth says their home value had gone up 10%, and they were counting on a new job in real estate for Joanna. But soon, the condo's value started to plummet, and her career was sidetracked by a third pregnancy. They also think they might have gotten the mortgage with stated income documents, but they're not sure.
So we're fuzzy on the details of our loan, which may be why we're in foreclosure.
You seem awfully fine with this. For a lot of people, going through a foreclosure and going through this whole process would be fairly traumatic.
I think we realize that it's a big deal, and we don't want to come across as sounding like, you know, oh, let your house go, it's no big deal. But I think at the same time we saw it, we weighed our options going into it, and we knew that it was a risk.
So you actually contemplated the possibility of foreclosure when you were buying the condo?
When you say it like that, I don't think when we originally bought it.
How do you feel about the fact that you're walking away from what was a responsibility on your part? And there's a lot of talk in Congress about, you know, well, should taxpayers rescue people who go into foreclosure?
I guess I don't really feel like Congress should bail us out. I feel like we should be the ones responsible for the, you know, consequences of that.
But what are the real consequences for you?
That's a good point. I mean, maybe there should be more consequences.
What will happen? Well, the Goslins will certainly take a major hit to their credit scores, and they'll have to wait 3 years before they're eligible for another home loan. But at this point, they will gladly exchange those for getting rid of their mortgage.
I think because it's happening to so many, it doesn't really feel like a stigma. It sort of feels like there seems to be a lot of sympathy.
It seems like a couple years ago, everybody at cocktail parties talked about how much their home value had increased. And now it's, you know, how many bank-owned properties there are on their block.
And in fact, foreclosure signs litter the lawns throughout the condo complex. As the Goslins lock up for the last time, Seth says they're looking forward to a fresh start in another state.
What are you going to do with your keys?
I guess we'll keep them while it's still in our name until the bank takes over.
Well, good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This weekend, the Goslins are starting over by moving to an apartment in a small coastal town in Oregon. They're counting on this year's tax refund and the federal stimulus check to get them by until Seth finds a job. Meanwhile, a bankruptcy court has cleared all of their debts off the books, except Joanna's student loans, and the condo will go on the auction block in 2 weeks. We have photos of the Goslins on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, unlike the Goslins, not every family facing foreclosure is packing up and heading out, despite what's happening to the neighborhood.
It's a shadow of its former self, really. Everybody's gone, just about, but five of us.
We visit a modern ghost town and its squatters. And later, a look at the future of housing reform.
We ought to shut the barn door to make sure horses don't leave tomorrow.
And by horses, he means real estate agents, mortgage brokers, bankers, appraisers, anyone who might help get you a house you can't afford. It's all coming up on Homesick, a special edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Drive south from Sacramento, where I met the Goslins, and you're in what's often referred to as America's salad bowl, mile after mile of verdant green farmland. It's also the epicenter of the housing mess. Stockton, California has the highest default rate in the nation. Keep heading down I-5 and you'll hit the town of Patterson, population 20,000. But despite its rural setting, it boasts the same kind of subdivisions you see in major metropolitan areas. And as of a couple of years ago, the same kind of prices.
Hey, Esme, you coming?
That's Dan Sinclair. He's a 43-year-old systems analyst who lives in Patterson with his wife Esmeralda and their three small children. We were heading out on a walk around his neighborhood, Dan wanted to show me just how many homes were for sale or simply abandoned.
All right, so here's a house you can see is in disrepair. I mean, it's not bad, but their lawn is not mowed. But that's one of the signs is when the lawn goes dead, you know that the people aren't living there anymore.
We only had to go three houses before finding another dried-up lawn with a sign that said bank owned. As we rounded a corner, the Sinclair's neighbors got up from their front porch and asked what we were doing. Larry and Kathy Fiddler have lived here since the development went up 4 years ago.
That's a shadow of its former self, really. Everybody's gone, just about, but five of us.
What's happened to your home value?
It's gone down probably 35 or 40%.
Larry says they plan to stick around. He's confident new residents will move in as prices drop. For a while, he and Kathy mowed the lawns of nearby empty houses until there were too many.
Well, that one there is just recently, I think they vacated it.
Are these foreclosure here?
That one is, and...
This one next door is.
That one there. So, yeah, we're pretty much surrounded.
Becoming a little ghost town. A little ghost street.
We continued on to the next ghost street, where the Sinclair's house is. They've watched it all happen, and they might be next.
What's going on?
They bought their house 3 years ago. It's 3,600 square feet, including a four-car garage and a pool. Their purchase price, $440,000.
But the prices kept going up. At one time, our house was worth over $600,000. In fact, a model just like this, they were asking $699,000. And now things have entirely collapsed.
A similar house down the street is already in foreclosure, and the bank is entertaining offers for under $200,000. The Sinclairs stopped paying their mortgage in October, when the payment jumped from $3,000 a month to $4,000. Now they're basically squatting in their own home, living there for free. It's happening all over the country because mortgage companies and bankruptcy courts are so backlogged, nobody's sending the sheriff to kick people out. The Sinclairs say they never meant for this to happen. But Esmeralda lost her job and a third child was on the way.
So we had to start making some hard choices, which included going into foreclosure on our house and kind of starting again. We're midway through the process. This is about a 6 to 8 month process, and we kind of have a plan of attack. Plan A doesn't work, we go to B, C, and D.
Plan A is asking the mortgage company to lower the principal they owe on the house, something Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke has suggested to the banking industry. Plan B, try for a short sale. Plan C, just walk away. Plan D, Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Many of the current government proposals call for reductions in interest rates. Dan says even that wouldn't be enough.
If they reduced our interest rate back to 4.25%, we might be able to make the payments, but I don't think we're going to.
Now, why not?
We would do it if the equity was there, but in a case where we're already so behind, imagine that for 5 years, say, we're going to pay $4,000 a month, and then we're just going to be back up at the what we bought the house for. Imagine how much we feel like we're throwing away money.
The Sinclairs say they want to take responsibility for their debts. But right now, it makes more financial sense not to.
I mean, you ask a good question is it really the right thing to do to let the mortgage companies take up the difference? That's a really tough ethical question.
Dan says he experienced the various stages of grief, including denial and anger. Now he's just relieved.
We went through months of being skinflints because we knew we were going into the red. So we didn't buy anything. No. All of a sudden, we have a bank full of money, and we're living rent-free, but we know that's not really our money.
How does that feel?
Great. No, like he said. I mean, we were so tight with money.
It does feel great.
It does feel great.
Because all of a sudden, we feel like we have a little margin now where we can go out to dinner, get a babysitter.
But you're not paying your mortgage.
I know.
You're not paying the biggest obligation you have. How does that feel good?
We already went through the guilt. This is really what we need to do. Not what we want to do, but what we needed to do.
And they say they are paying a price. They're losing their home, most likely, and their credit is shot.
It's also our dream that's just not there anymore. Everybody dreams about owning a house, having a house, and now it's gone. And
but not everybody would think that they should get into a 3,000 square foot house.
Yes, you're right.
And that's taught us a lesson.
Their next home, the Sinclairs say, will be a much smaller one. We've got photos of the Sinclairs and all those for sale signs around their neighborhood on our website. It's marketplace.org.
boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same.
Economists describe the housing boom as yet another market mania, just like the dot-com frenzy. People's perceptions of the housing market reality were altered by everything from dinner party gossip to, yes, media hype. Jump in before it's too late. But some of the changes in homeowner psychology go beyond mania. There's a longer-term shift in how people think about their homes. And here to put us all on the couch is Chris Thornburg. He's an economist here in Los Angeles and has been watching the housing market for years. Chris, nice to see you again.
Absolutely great to be here.
You know, it seems like for time and memoriam, one of the big financial goals in life was to pay off your house, do whatever it took to get to that mortgage burning party. Would you agree that we, many of us at least, think of our mortgages differently now?
I think certainly so. I think we live in a much more sophisticated age. If you look back over time, for your vast majority of households, their primary asset was their house. Most economists today would say that if you actually paid off your house, you have a portfolio that's probably weighted too much towards your house. 50 years ago, it made more sense.
Is this a generational shift at all? Because I have to tell you, you know, when I got my first mortgage, the way I think about it, I really think about it as a monthly payment. I'm not planning to be in that house until I retire. I will probably move within the next 10 years. But my parents, I think, look at this and say, you're not planning to pay off your mortgage as quickly as you possibly can? When did that shift happen?
I have had this same conversation with my father. My father has paid off his mortgage. Half his assets are in his house. I said, that's crazy. He says, well, that's the way I like it. It is a different era. We are people who are less rooted to a particular place. I also think that in many ways, previous generations went through substantially more financial turmoil than I think our generation has experienced, at least up till now. But of course, what we're talking about here is because we move so much, we don't need to have a house paid off because, hey, we can get up and go anywhere we want. And in many ways, we live in a world where we have access to financial markets at the individual level. This isn't the realm of the elite anymore.
In that case, what's wrong with 100% financing, interest-only loans, in order to get you into that house?
The issue, of course, today, at the same time that we have unparalleled access to financial markets and ability to invest and buy stuff, we also have a situation where Americans don't save anymore. That kind of attitude is very, very problematic for the future of the U.S. economy. It's very sad that people seem to have lost the sense of the future. Maybe our confidence in the future is so great, we don't realize the kind of risk we're putting ourselves into.
Well, that was certainly the case when, you know, people were buying and getting homes based on the idea that the value would always go up.
Right. Why do I have to save anything when I can buy assets that only go up in value? Well, guess what? Home prices don't go up forever and ever. In fact, now we're going through the painful process of home prices coming down.
When we talk about the psychology of home ownership, you really have to address this idea of the American dream and that a big part of that is owning a house. Should our notion of well-being be so tied to the idea of home ownership? Because it certainly isn't in other Western societies.
Absolutely not. Yet again, so much of the rhetoric going on out there in the context of the current crisis seems to be wrapped around this idea that, my God, we have to keep people in their homes no matter what. Home ownership is not the be-all and end-all. Home ownership is not the holy grail. There are plenty of people in plenty of circumstances for whom living in an apartment is a very logical thing to do.
Chris Thornburg is the founder of Beacon Economics here in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
So Chris Thornburg says home ownership is not the holy grail. That may be, but it's awfully exciting. We bought our first home 4 years ago this month, and I remember sitting on the front steps, glass of champagne in hand, marveling at the idea that we owned this little slice of the planet. Amid all the gloom and doom of the housing crisis, we found one couple who will move this weekend into their new home in Santa Clarita, California. They're looking forward to stepping over their own threshold after living in a Burbank apartment since 2002.
The kitchen's tiny. It's really hot in the summer, really cold in the winter. Yeah, I seriously didn't think we could last here for 6 years. That's pretty amazing to me.
But we did. That shows that our marriage is good.
My name is Richard Lee, and I'm a project manager at UCLA.
My name is Judy Lee, and I'm a graphic designer. I think in the early 2000s, few of our friends were able to buy a place, and we briefly thought about it and realized that, you know, we needed to pay off some of our debt first, and was hoping that in a couple of years we would be able to buy, but then the housing market just went crazy, going, you know, straight up. And for us, you know, buying a $500,000 house at that time didn't seem like a very wise decision.
We were just kind of tired of renting, and we just wanted to have our own place, and we were just hoping for the right time, you know, when we could actually possibly buy a home.
All the books say that the bottom will reach, you know, the summer or the end of 2008, but our real estate agent said, well, you can wait in the summer, but there will be a lot of families with children who will start looking then as well, because they all want to move before school starts. And, you know, at first I thought it was just kind of a sales tactic, like, you got to buy now, or else you're going to miss your chance kind of a thing. But I think talking to a couple of our friends who do have children, I realized that there probably is going to be a lot more buyers this summer. So for us, it just made sense that if we found a great home for a good price, that we should buy as soon as possible.
We actually considered the market and some of the news reports and market reports that we were hearing. And even if the market were to drop and hit rock bottom maybe 2-3 years down the road, then, you know, we'll just stay. We weren't looking to flip the house or that type of thing. And we weren't really interested in that. We wanted to buy a home and we want to stay.
And I think that there's so much past emphasis on, you know, value of the home and increasing value or lowering value. And so many people have made so much money off of these homes in California. But really, our basic reasons are very foundational, which is we want to just have a home where we could hopefully start a family. And if it takes 10 years, then we'll be fine. And a lot of the people who are pushed out, that's all they really want, is to be able to live in a home. And they're not so worried about, oh, is the value going to drop within the next year or the next 2 years? Because if they're thinking long term, if they're thinking 5, 10, 15 years, then eventually the housing market will go back up and become normal again.
Richard and Judy Lee talking about the big move to their first house this weekend. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. One of the first things potential homeowners want to know is how long a house has been on the market. The older the listing, the more desperate the seller. Or at least that's the thinking. But these days, it's fairly standard for homes to be on the market for months. And that's led some sellers to resort to a questionable tactic that makes old listings look new again. We asked Marketplace's Dan Gretz to explain.
Carl Jones picks through the carnage of the housing market. He's research director for Condo Vultures, a real estate brokerage in Miami. Today, he's scouring the property database for an example of relisting. That's when a seller takes a property off the market, then puts it right back on to make it appear to be a brand new listing.
This is actually a perfect example here. This is one of the top luxury buildings in South Beach.
It's a 600-square-foot studio apartment in the Setai. It sold for $688,000 in late 2005. 4 months later, the buyer put it back up for sale at $1 million. But as the real estate market tanked, the price was cut and cut again. After a few keystrokes, Carl discovers there's more to the story.
We flip over to this side, we can actually see that it was actually switched from this MLS number to this MLS number here.
That switch? That's relisting. When a house or condo goes up for sale, it's assigned a multiple listing service, or MLS number. When you relist, you reset the clock.
The 1961 Ferrari 250 GT, California.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Remember at the end when Ferris and Cameron run the Ferrari in reverse to roll back the odometer? That's relisting. Again, Carl Jones.
It's giving it a new number. It's a new identity. And if you don't know what you're doing, you're not going to know the full history of this property. You have to go looking for it. You have to know what you're looking for.
It turns out the Satai Studio apartment has a long history of rejection.
You're seeing the price start at a high and then drop again after 6 months. That property was relisted, same agent, new MLS number, again goes back up to the high that it was 6 months previous and then started to drop again.
Eventually, the property was yanked off the market. For brokers in a down economy, relisting can be a powerful tool. That's because each morning, new listings are added to what brokers dub the hot sheet. Author Elise Glink runs expertrealestatetips.net.
When a property is listed, it instantly alerts brokers. You'll see in somebody's email, it pops up, pop, 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 pop. You know, it's all hot stuff.
Glink says if a seller drops the price or improves the property, relisting is a legitimate way to announce the change. It's also a questionable way for brokers to promote themselves. Many agents use relisting so they can claim to sell homes faster than their competitors. Other agents use relisting to hide a property's troubled past. Peter Zalewski's founder of Condo Vultures.
Many of the agents are trying to relist this to get savvy buyers off the scent that there might be some distrust with a particular property. The goal is go in there aggressively, come in with a high price, and hope that your pie-in-the-sky price might actually find a sucker.
Each region sets its own rules about relisting. In Minneapolis, you can take down a property and immediately repost it. In Sacramento, one-third of all new properties were actually relistings. That is, until the local listing agency clamped down on the practice. Now a property can only be relisted if its price is cut or the property is improved, say with a new paint job. Other regions have gone further, imposing 30-day minimums between listings. Ron Shuffield is president of EWM Realtors, Miami's second-largest brokerage. He says a buyer's best strategy is to hire an established firm that will research a property's listing history.
We don't encourage relisting. It's certainly not something that we ever include in our training. Our managers don't talk about it. I don't talk about it. I would say that there are other methods that we have found to be more productive than that.
Like facing the reality of a down market and pricing the home properly from the start. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace Money.
Up next, for real estate agents, the term bank-owned home is a four-letter word.
They're trashed. They are artificially driving the price down. It's not really what the market would be bearing.
But for some buyers, bank-owned home spells opportunity. And Chris takes your calls on saving for a down payment and what you should know before signing a rent-to-own agreement. It's all coming up on Homesick, a special edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. I drive by the Rose Bowl in Pasadena every so often. It's not far from my house. One area caught my eye the other day. It's about a half mile from houses that cost $1 million or more. There's this one cute little ranch for sale. But the owner says he's probably taking it off the market this weekend. Why? It's surrounded by a sea of bargain-priced homes that are in foreclosure. That same scene is playing out across the country, including Sacramento. We return there now for a story from Marianne Russ about sellers struggling to beat the bank.
When my husband and I bought our first home a couple of months ago, we looked at a dozen or so houses. Every single one was bank-owned. It wasn't a conscious decision. It's just the prices were so much lower. But if you have to sell your house right now, that's not the kind of thing you want to hear. Alan Wagner is a realtor in Elk Grove, a city near Sacramento.
In the real estate world, as I sometimes will share with people, there's always a reason for someone to sell, and that always reason is death, divorce, and transfers.
Wagner says the toughest part of his job is convincing an individual seller his house is probably worth a lot less than he thinks it is.
And when you say, but I've got $30,000 worth of upgrades, I've got $100,000 upgrades, I've got gold-plated widgets in my house. No one cares that you've got a gold-plated widget because the bank is $20,000 less than what you think your house is worth. They can buy those widgets.
To prove the point, Wagner and I do a little experiment. He checks the regular listings in Elk Grove. The average price is $447,000. Yes. Then he does the same search, but includes bank-owned homes and short sales, Those are the ones in pre-foreclosure. The total inventory more than doubles, and it knocks the average price down to $370,000. The bank-owned homes have pushed the average price 80 grand lower.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm the agent.
Hi, I'm Jesse.
Hi, Jesse.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Real estate agent Michael Freeman is doing what he does most Sundays, holding an open house in this three-bedroom Sacramento home.
As we come up here, we have a really nice, I think, open floor plan again.
Freeman has staged the immaculate home, cookbooks on the counter, teddy bears in a pink bedroom upstairs. The problem is he's competing against a four-bedroom bank-owned home just two houses down. Even though that house is bigger, it's being offered at 40 grand less.
We have bank REO properties that are coming on, and they're trashed. They are artificially driving the price down because it's not really what the market would be bearing, but the buyer is going to take advantage of that.
To be honest, that's what my husband and I did. But our house was like many of the bank properties we saw. Baseboards and closet doors stripped off, holes in the nicotine-stained walls, bird poop on the kitchen floor, and mold growing under the sink. Freeman and I decided to check out the bank-owned home down the street to see what shape it's in.
But you're in for a treat right now.
There's stained carpet, crayon drawings on the walls, and a stove caked with grease that's beyond salvaging. But that smells like opportunity to Patricia Galdamez, who shows up for a tour. She says her husband can fix it up.
It takes time for him because, you know, we're working overtime and blah, blah, blah. But if we can do it, I just say we can save a couple thousands.
But there is hope for individual sellers. Agents Freeman and Wagner say they'll have to be realistic and lower their prices, but a furnished, spotless home will always show better. And then there are buyers like Jesse Monnier, who's willing to pay a little more for a home that's in better shape.
You know, all this free time for renovations, I just don't have. And so by the time I had time to make the renovations, you know, I'd still have to live for 3 years in someone else's yuckiness. I'd just rather not.
In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
It's clear from the real estate wreckage that a lot of homeowners asked for and got mortgages that they could not afford. But as anyone who's been through the process will tell you, even with all the online calculators out there promising to figure out what your bank account can tolerate, it's still something of a crapshoot. Commentator Dan Ariely is in the market, and this MIT professor doesn't have any more of a clue than the rest of us.
My wife and I are currently house hunting. So we've been thinking about how difficult it is to calculate the optimal amount of money we should spend on a house and how much of it we should take as a mortgage. To work this out, we need to take into account our current income, our expected future income, our predictions for the stock market and the housing market, and the interest rate of mortgages today and in the future. On top of that, we need to consider the amount of happiness different houses will provide us, and how will that level of happiness measure up against the lifetime cost of these homes. 41 years of education between us does not seem to be enough to figure this out. Standard economics assume that we'll always act in a way that serves our best interest. But it's very difficult for us to calculate what's in our best interest in terms of home purchasing. So, how can we be sure that our decision will maximize our welfare? Calculating the right amount we should be spending and borrowing is so complex, and banks don't do much these days to help us determine how much we should borrow. So what did we do? We realized that figuring this out rationally was a lost cause. So we relied on some simple but arbitrary factors. We picked a neighborhood that we liked a lot. We found a house that we liked the most within this neighborhood. Then we offered to buy it for $10,000 less than the asking price. I think that the owners of that house could have asked for $100,000 more or $100,000 less than their current price, and we would have still offered them just a bit less than their asking price. The problem is that we just have no idea how much this house is worth to us. We don't know how to translate the pleasure we expect to get from it to the amount we're willing to pay for it. And if the sellers accept our offer, we still have to decide how much to borrow and get a mortgage. This ordeal is clearly not a rational decision-making process, but at least we are now closer to having a home.
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at MIT. His new book is called Predictably Irrational. All right, it's time for Getting Personal when we answer your questions. And we do have a lot of questions about the current housing crisis. And so with me once again is our own Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go right to the phones. Our first caller has a bunch of questions herself. Judith is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Judith.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing well. Do you work for Uncle Sam there?
I actually work for Geico.
Geico. So you work for a lizard instead of Uncle Sam?
Yes, I work for the gecko.
Well, tell us your question for Chris today.
I actually wanted to know just, you know, ways of saving money and just getting ready for home purchasing. I actually just got out of college only about 3 years ago. And in the market that we're in right now, it's very difficult to sort of put money aside and still invest and, you know, get ready for home buying.
So how old are you?
I am 24.
Okay. And what's your household income, can we ask?
Together, I just got married about 2 weeks ago. Now it's about $86,000 a year.
Well, congratulations on your marriage.
Thank you.
And do you have any savings?
We do. I spent a lot of it during the wedding.
Sure.
Probably about $4,000 in savings.
Okay. And what kind of debt are you looking at right now?
About $18,000 in student loans, and my husband about $17,000 in student loans, and maybe about $6,000 or $7,000 in credit card debt.
Well, Chris, sounds like they're certainly on their way, but probably going to need to rack up a little more in savings, huh?
I think so. I mean, a couple of things. I mean, I think it's terrific that you paid for your wedding out of savings rather than going into debt. By the way, don't believe anyone that tells you you have to move quickly because now is the time. This is the time you get the deals. It's going to take a long time for the housing market to unwind. So let's get rid of the credit card debt. And getting rid of the credit card debt and paying your student loans on time, you're going to boost your credit score. In terms of savings, I would put it into a conservative money market mutual fund. Your principal is safe, you make some interest, and you have easy access to the money whether you need it in a year or in 3 years. And then here's where the fun comes in. Research. Work with a real estate agent and examine households and neighborhoods and where would you want to live. I'd also go to a banker and say, what can we qualify for? How much of a mortgage can we get? If we boosted our savings to X amount, what would you lend to us? And then in a year or 2 years, you can make your move with good credit and better savings and, most importantly, really know the market and know where it makes sense for you to move as a first-time home buyer.
Does that sound like something you could work toward, Judith?
It does.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Judith.
Thank you.
All right, let's reach into the email bag. Ginny writes in from Thousand Palms, California, and she has seen a number of places for rent that offer something called a rent to own, and she wants to know what is the scoop on this arrangement.
Well, this is largely for people with little cash or poor credit, and they sign an agreement, and you pay more than what your rent would be. So it's rent plus a rent premium, and that goes toward equity if you complete the purchase of the home, typically between 1 and 3 years. A couple of cautionary notes. In a lot of low-income communities, this has been an area of scandal. There is a business among unscrupulous landlords who will have tenants come in, sign rent-to-own agreements. You're paying higher rent. Then you find some reason to evict them. You bring somebody else in. If you're interested in a rent-to-own where we're talking a legitimate deal, there are two types. One is called an option. That means you don't have to go through with the deal. You have the option to do the deal. That's what you want. You don't want to do what's called a purchase agreement, which you're committed, say, in 2 years, to actually come through with the purchase. You know, rent-to-owns are complicated. My feeling is you need some expertise. You need a lawyer. For most people who will be working with a lawyer, they can probably do better in the conventional market rather than the rent-to-own market.
All right, Jenny. So some cautionary notes from Chris, but you could check it out on your own with a lawyer if you'd like. All right, let's go to caller number two. And Norman is with us from Weezer, Idaho. Hi, Norman.
Hi.
So tell us what your question is for Chris today.
Well, I'm 70 years old, and I recently bought a home in Weezer, Idaho, and paid cash for it, which was all the cash I had. And, well, that's $100,000 in Weezer. They're not so expensive. After I got it, then I realized I didn't have any money to live on other than a little retirement I have. So I was curious if there was any way I could get a mortgage against a portion of that value that would support me between 70 and 90 or whatever I'm going to live.
Hmm. Chris, my guess is that we're probably going to now talk about something called a reverse mortgage.
That's right. This is what a reverse mortgage is designed for. If you think about your normal mortgage, you have a lot of debt, a little bit of equity. Every month you pay that mortgage, you have falling debt, rising equity. With a reverse mortgage, you take the equity out of the home and you use that as income, and then you pay off the debt when you move or you die. And you cannot be kicked out of your home, by the way. They're complicated. There is rising scandal at the same time. There's a lot of abuses in this market, but I definitely would investigate whether or not a reverse mortgage is going to work for you.
Chris, isn't this specifically designed for older Americans? And what's the age at which you can start doing this?
You have to be over 62 and a half in order to qualify for a reverse mortgage. So that's not an issue in this particular case. One very good source of information on a reverse mortgage is the website of the AARP. AARP.org, and they have a very simplistic calculator. It can at least give you an idea of how much you would be able to take out of the home, how much income you would have. And at least it's something to get you thinking whether or not this is going to be worth it for you to do.
Okay. Does that help you out, Norman?
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call, Norman, and good luck.
Oh, I thank you.
If you need some help sorting fact from fiction, do let us help. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. Thanks as always for the great advice, Chris.
Thanks.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So let's try to end on a hopeful note. There's got to be a solution to this mortgage mess, although none of the current fixes seem to be stanching the flow of red ink throughout the housing market. Our friend Nick Ritsinas is here. He teaches housing economics at Harvard. And Nick, yes, we've heard and seen lots of proposals, but why can't the bigwigs seem to get this thing under control?
A couple reasons. One, I think there is a general reluctance to interfere in the marketplace. Number two, there are lots of disagreements about how to intervene. And thirdly, this will be a very expensive intervention.
Well, let's talk about one of the plans currently being debated in Congress. This is becoming known as Frank Dodd for Representative Barney Frank and Senator Chris Dodd, who are talking about essentially beefing up the Federal Housing Administration and using that agency to help solve this problem. Can you give us kind of a quick look at what this proposal is?
Sure. The gist of it is to use the insurance and guarantee authority of the Federal Housing Administration. The notion is that the loans that people are delinquent and defaulting on would be recalibrated and recast, and part of that loan would be guaranteed by the government.
Well, let me ask you to apply this to a real-world example. Earlier in the show, we heard about the Goslins, who bought a condo in Sacramento for $193,000 3 years ago. It's now worth $95,000. They're walking away. What kind of alternative would this legislation provide?
Well, if this legislation were to go forward and it work, what it would probably do is say to that family, well, now you have a new mortgage, and that new mortgage is much closer to the market value and much closer, we hope, to what you can afford to pay. Understanding that, you no longer have a home and are unlikely to have a home that will be valued up to your original purchase price.
What kind of reforms do you expect to see or would you like to see in terms of mortgage brokers, the appraisal business, kind of all these players within this crisis who at this point everybody says it wasn't my fault?
Well, I think we ought to shut the barn door to make sure horses don't leave tomorrow. I think the kinds of reforms that are spoken to, which is more licensing and oversight of mortgage brokers, more liability and responsibility to the participants in a lending decision, all make sense. Those are reforms to make sure we don't repeat the same mistakes 5-10 years from now.
For those folks who were more prudent than others and decided to wait out the housing boom, is there any way for them to know when we've hit bottom?
Not really, because you have to look at so many other factors. Like any asset class, you only know you hit bottom after you've reached it and sort of turned the corner. But certainly for anyone sort of looking to buy, I think they have to put a premium on, is this a place I really want to live in? Is this a place I want to raise a family? I think in the recent past, we've been a little too biased toward investment value. I think that has to take a back seat for a while.
So the home has to become a place that you really want to live in.
It's going to be a place to live in, not a place to buy and sell.
Nick Ritsinas is director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, nonprofits help people save when they have no money to save.
And that just got me to them, because I need money, right? Okay, so what do I have to do?
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.